The Hatchcast is sponsored in part by Spartan Innovations. Spartan Innovations provides startups spinning out of MSU's ecosystem the commercialization support and financial resources necessary to turn MSU research technologies into successful Michigan businesses.
This episode of the Hatchcast is brought to you by the MSU Entrepreneurship Association. The MSUEA is a registered student organization open to all majors who are passionate about entrepreneurship. Find out more at msuea.org.
This episode of the Hatchcast is brought to you by Burgess Institute for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. The Burgess Institute empowers students to learn through action by providing programs, courses, and resources to foster an entrepreneurial mindset and create new ventures. One name, one program, Limitless U. Learn more at eship.msu.edu.
Welcome to
Creativity,
Risk-Taking,
Entrepreneurship,
Community,
Innovation,
Ambition.
This is
the Hatchcast.
Welcome to the fourth Innovate State of the Year. Thanks for being here. Thank you for the silent clap. I appreciate it. For those of you joining us the web, welcome. One quick announcement. We do have back-to-back Innovate States coming up here pretty quickly. So actually on Monday, we got another Innovate State coming up. So make sure to check in as well for that date and join us again. So it'll be a lot of fun. So pretty quickly. Tonight, my guest is Anurag Kumar. The founder and CEO of iTexico. He is a Wayne State grad, an IIT grad in India, and then also a Michigan State MBA student. So he's spent a lot of time in the Mitten. My name is Ken Smusiak. I am the managing director for the Burgess Institute for Entrepreneurship and the host for the evening. With that, we're going to dive right in. So thanks, Anurag, for coming.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
So I'm just wondering if they can hear me okay. Can you?
We're good to go.
Can you understand? Can you understand me?
Yep.
I thought if Siri and Alexa can understand me,
right,
these guys can too.
They can understand you. They got you. All right. So for those of you who haven't been to Innovate State, which I think many of you have, the way this works is we essentially have a fireside chat minus the fire about what it's like to start a company, innovate, come up with new ideas, and we like to pick the brains of our most famous alums to learn habits, practices, good stories.
Not sure about the famous part.
Yeah,
definitely an
infamous.
Alum.
Maybe infamous, I don't know. We'll see. So I started the last time I hosted this was three episodes ago, I suppose, and I started with a time travel question, which was 19-year-old Anurag Kumar is it at undergraduate on a random. What are we on Wednesday today? What was undergrad life like for you, and how did it spur your entrepreneurial spirit, and what did you gain most out of being in college?
19 years.
That's
a long time ago. You weren't even born when I was 19. Most of us. No, it's I grew up in India in an average middle class family. As a really good student, valedictorian and all that. So I got into this place called IIT, and I'm not sure if you have heard, but it's kind of hard to get in. Like maybe 0.01% of the applicants get in. So I go to the IIT. I was a valedictorian in my school, number one and all that. And suddenly I'm surrounded by everyone who's a valedictorian from around the country. And I just realized that I can beat these guys. So I have to find a different game to play so I can, succeed. And so being in business struck out. I was never a good programmer myself. Or in computer science. I also realized that after you graduate, the kind of job opportunities we had in India in 1980s, they didn't pay a whole lot of money. Yeah. So in order to make some financial impact, you have to figure out a way to get into the business. So there's always this desire to make some money, to be financially well off. And I always thought that perhaps one day I could get into business. So after I graduated, I was always doing two jobs. The thing which happens in India is to get into business, you need money. And it's also not part of the culture. So I had to take up a job until I was able to come to US. And that's how I got into, starting new things. And that's another story on how I actually got to start my first company.
So when you were at a young age, did you have an entrepreneurial spirit? Were you always kind of, or were you more focused on studies at the time?
I was focused on studies. Always studied well, focused on getting good grades. And early on, yes, there was a focus on getting a really good job for as long as I can get it. But it was not an option to be an entrepreneur when I was growing up. Unlike a lot of you, you do have a lot of choices. And I'm actually jealous of you guys. You know, you're being taught how to be an entrepreneur. The only thing we were taught was how to get really, really good grades. And it's a huge difference when I see you all, and when I remember my time in those chairs. We didn't have those fancy chairs in my days, but you can imagine those benches, the wooden benches and all that.
Right. Yeah. So you make your way to America and spend some more time in schooling, right?
Both. No,
and,
actually, I came here to work.
Oh, to work, okay.
So I came here to work as a programmer, as a contract programmer for Tata's. And in 1984, I left them and found another job in Detroit. Now, that job, it turned out, was a contract programming job. I didn't know the difference between a contract programmer and a full-time. So 6 months into the contract programming job, the contract disappeared. So I was actually without a job, but I didn't know that. And then my employer called me. He says, you know, you won't get paid. I said, what happened? I'm still employed, right? Yeah, you have a job, but you don't have a job.
Like, you can't,
you're not going to pay you because your contract is over. So they found me another one, but it started dawning on me that, you know, at some point I need to be in control. I can't be jumping between contracts. So I got another contract, and lo and behold, a year later, even that went away. And that's when it started hitting me. And in those days, the economy was not doing very well. So getting a job with Ford or GM and Chrysler, those are the three main employers, was really, really hard. So I kept finding these contract jobs. So I actually formed my own company so I can cut the middle guy. I said, if I'm going to be on a contractor, why pay 30% to the middle guy? Get the whole thing. And that was my first foray into being a contractor. And it was an amazing experience. So I was a contractor with KPMG. And so I'd lost my job. I found another job with KPMG as a contract programmer. They doubled my hourly wage. So every week I would get this check for 35 times 40. Who's the maths guy here? $1,400. Every week I'll get it. I didn't know that at some point I have to pay taxes. Yes, I'm a 1099. I'm a contract employee.
Right, right.
So I thought I was rich. I was spending all that money. And that was a big financial hit when the tax time comes. And then I had to actually pay taxes and find money.
This is important. No, if you are working on a contract, the employer is not responsible for paying.
No, you are.
You are.
But,
right?
We don't know about taxes. So that was an interesting experience. But it was almost out of necessity that I went on my own, knowing that I can't rely on a regular job. So I call myself as an accidental entrepreneur. There's no game plan, there's no business plan, there's no funding. You just do it because that's the only option you have.
Right. But having this, so I often tell students about this in class, is that people kind of run into an entrepreneurial journey at different points in their career or kind of how it gets started. And actually, the average age for someone starting a company is somewhere in their 40s now, right? Like low 40s, 41, 42, something like that. Did you find your time in industry to be the thing that made you become cognizant of the problems that needed to be solved?
Yes. So what happened was, so I stayed as a contract programmer for a while under my own umbrella. So technically, I did have a company of my own in Michigan. In 92, I did find a real job. So I was able to get into IBM. And that was a good experience. You know, you learned a lot. You actually learn how to interact with other qualified people. They also paid for my B school. That's how I actually ended up doing my EMBA at Michigan State, because IBM did pay for it. And in 96, they moved me to Austin. And I was turning 38, you mentioned the age. It was 1999, and I'm not sure how many of you remember late 90s, 99, 2000. That was the bubble of entrepreneurship and VC funding.
99 was a party. 2000 was a not such a great party.
So what happened was, I was at IBM. I started seeing some challenges in a specific space as a programmer. So I came up with some ideas. I started shopping it around, and I got $1 million from Austin Ventures. So I left a really, really nice job at IBM to this venture-funded startup. We raised another $13 million in 2000. So July of 2000, if you go and do the history of VC funding, was the peak. That's the time where most of the VC funding was done, and we were one of them in July of 2000. So we raised money. Unfortunately, things didn't go quite as well. But that leaving IBM and getting to this venture funding was probably my first real entrepreneurial journey. And I was 38, so you're right. It took me a while to do something on my own. The good news was, I was able to save some money along the way. So financially, I was kind of in a reasonably okay position. So I didn't have to worry about the family and the wife and the house. And that allowed me some flexibility in going on my own.
Right. So that idea of kind of de-risking that leap was
interesting. A hungry entrepreneur is sometimes can get desperate. So, any one of you who's trying to get into your own, make sure you have staying power. Make sure you can put food on the table. Make sure you have some money behind you.
Avoid total ruin.
otherwise it gets really, really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. And then, so you had this company you started. It raised some money. A lot of money, right?
Had a good time.
From other people's money.
Yeah.
And 2000 happens. The trajectory of the company, not so good.
They fired me as a CEO. The VCs, they brought in some other CEO. They call it upgrading. So they upgraded me.
So you got upgraded out of your own company.
I was upgraded out of my own company.
This happens a lot, by the way.
Happens a lot. It's happening a little less now. And I was really upset. They paid me. So I started another company. I said, I'm not going to take any VC money. I'm going to do it on my own. And that turned out to be a long, hard journey. I went without paycheck for a while, but it did okay. I was able to sell it in 2007. So it kind of worked out. And I didn't think about getting another job. I said, I was kind of really mad that they kicked me out of my own company, and I wanted to do it again. So that was my second entrepreneurial venture.
So comparing the two, where you brought in investor money and you lose control in many ways when you do that, depending on the percentage of ownership and those types of things. And then this self-funded, bootstrapped, Anurag is just going to take the reins and I'm going to find a way to cash flow and make this thing work. Compare and contrast those two experiences. I mean, obviously the first one didn't go so well. Did you feel it was your relationship with the investors? You didn't have a great relationship with them? Like, if you rewound the clock, would you have thought about even starting that first company in a different manner?
So I don't think I had the right partner. So what happened was they were funding teams in those days. If you just went out and started to raise venture capital, the first question was, who is your team? So I found a guy who was in IBM. I convinced him to leave his job, become a co-founder. Then I founded another one of my classmates from IIT who was between jobs. He had a good position, good, smart guy. So I brought him as a co-founder. I think that was probably my first mistake, is not to have the right founding team. I just brought in two other 38-year-old guys who looked like me, but they had no idea what I was trying to do. They were excited that I was able to raise money. I had money to pay them and all that. So I think not having the right team kind of hurt me. And those guys, I believe, weren't on my side when things were not going well. So I think VCs probably decided that these three guys are not working well together. Let's kick one guy out and maybe the other two can work together. So that was one. When I was on my own, it was a little easy to control what you can do, but not having capital also slows you down. So it's always, how fast can you grow? Can you make some critical investments? Could you hire some people? Could you do some marketing? And that always requires money. Right. So 100% bootstrapping is also not that easy. And sometimes you just have to find the right moment, or maybe something happens, you land up with a big contract, or maybe you can attract some money. So a lot of things kind of have to happen before you hit the success mark. When I had my VC startup, I didn't have to worry about money. So we could hire anyone. We were stealing people from other companies. We were paying them a lot of salaries. We were going to Las Vegas on the computer CES show spending money, like, you know, it's not our money, so right. How does it matter?
It's better to spend other people's money.
Right. And, you know, especially in those days, they were just, don't worry about money, spend and all that. So right. It was fun, but it was not fun when it came to managing, or not fun having to deal with someone you have to report to. So it turned out to be an experience like you have a job, that you have to satisfy someone else with what you're doing, and someone is watching you. I didn't feel like I was in control, although I had the title of CEO and all that. Second time, at least I knew if I fail, it's because of me. If I succeed, it's going to be because of me. So I guess that was but it also was a little slow process. So, you know, if I have to pick and choose, I'll probably still go with the bootstrapping side.
Right. Does that bring us up to the founding of iTexico then, roughly?
Not yet.
There's one in between?
Yes. So then what happened was I sold that company and I was trying to find what to do next. So I got this opportunity to be the CEO of a software company in India. And, you know, I had not worked in India since I graduated almost, 24 years ago. So I took that as an opportunity. It was a turnaround situation. So I was traveling between India and Austin on a regular basis. So I turned it around, I was able to sell it. And that kind of opened my eyes to this global experience of managing software development and servicing customers. So I learned a lot by running this company based in India with customers in US. So that was a bit revealing. I split the company, sold it off, and then I got another company, similar company to run. So I had two experiences to run companies based out of India. I stayed in Austin, and that had started giving me some ideas because I found it really hard to service US customers with teams in India. You have this time zone issue, you know, 12 hours or 11 and a half hours. It's a distance, you know, going there, you know, try going from Lansing to India, you have to first drive to Detroit and then fly to some other city in Europe. And then it takes a while. It takes 24 hours on a good day. And I was always thinking, is there a better way to service the clients? Is there something different we could do? And that's when I exited my second company in India, is when I actually met my co-founder, Guillermo Ortega. He's from Guadalajara, Mexico. So I was speaking in an event like this, and he comes over and he starts talking to me about this something going on in Mexico, that they have programmers, and I'm thinking, they have programmers in Mexico, really? And I'm in this city called Guadalajara, and I said, how do you spell that? And where exactly it is. But anyway, I got intrigued. I actually flew to Mexico.
Yeah.
I saw the environment, I saw the infrastructure, I met some technical folks, and I thought, perhaps this is an opportunity to do a better version of providing services to customers in US and meeting the demand. And that was the genesis. There was no business plan. I didn't do a site search. I had no idea who this guy is. I met him and his wife and his three kids. So, you know, they look like good human beings. What could be possibly wrong with them? I mean, I'd never worked with anyone in Mexico. I mean, I had no idea how the dynamics.
How's your Spanish?
I still don't do any Spanish, except uno más cerveza, give me another beer. I had no idea what I was doing. And in hindsight, it sounds kind of crazy that you would do that. But I guess that's who entrepreneurs are. I mean, you know, you just take a chance. And, you know, it's like baseball. Before you hit a home run, you have a lot of strikeouts. So I guess that's what we are used to, strikeouts. And once in a while, some home run might happen.
Right.
But that was how iTexico started. And before I did that, you know, it took me a year to actually start with him. So I was doing some CEO coaching. I was doing some independent consulting. But yeah, in 2011, we actually took the plunge. I borrowed some money from my wife. He borrowed it from his wife. You know,
off to the races.
And, but it took us almost 2 years before we started paying ourselves. So, you know, it is, fortunately, it's a services industry. This cash flow is okay. You know, you get paid and you pay the employees. So we were able to build it up to around 50 employees in 2 years. And I remember my first paycheck was $1,000. It's like, wow, I'm actually making some money now.
Right. Good salary yourself. Good.
So, and then next month we gave ourselves 100% raise, so we actually paid ourselves $2,000, and it's been okay since then.
Right. Yeah. And you have about 300 employees now.
So I have around 350 employees.
In iTexico.
We have been growing pretty well. The whole space of what is called nearshoring is evolving really well. There is a talent shortage in US. You know, all the digital innovation going on. You need developers, you need programmers, you need talent. And I don't know how many of you are actually software developers, but it turns out that software development is really, really hard. It's like writing music. It's like painting. It is creative. You have to craft a solution. It's not like building blocks. If I give the same problem to 10 programmers, I'll have 10 solutions. So this industry has a natural attrition. I'm one of them. I was never a good programmer, so I became a project manager as soon as I could, because I just didn't enjoy writing code. So this industry will continue to have a shortage of supply. And that's why most of the companies in US, they're looking for sources wherever they can find talent. So they found it in India, they found it in China, in Eastern Europe. Finding talent in Mexico or some Latin American countries is kind of a new phenomena. And people are realizing that there is good talent out there. And it's become really, really hot. So we are actually being pursued by other companies as a possible exit. So it turned out to be, but it's very accidental. There's no planning or anything like that.
I often talk about finding these niche markets, though, and this is an interesting one. So for those of you who are still catching up onto what's happening with Anurag's company, is that essentially you're using coders in Latin America and Mexico to write software code that would normally have been done in India or China or Eastern Europe, where these time zone lags and communication issues become a major detriment to business as usual, depending on the type of client, right? So then it's finding the types of clients that need to stay in the same time zone as the people that are writing code for them so they can have a greater interaction. So you found this kind of niche market where there's your clients are the types of companies that require this type of service as opposed to really looking outside of the US outside of the time zone.
I think most of the clients want collaboration. They want communication with their developers. They want same time zone. They don't want to wake up at night to talk to someone. They can't depend on the email. Imagine sending an email to a programmer, hey, I have a bug. And the guy wakes up in the morning and he doesn't understand what the bug is. So he writes you back, what bug are we talking about? That's a 2-day lag. So by the time you solve that bug, it might be 48 hours because of the time zone. Whereas if you have the teams working in the same time zone, you can solve it in 5 minutes. So time zone, proximity. The other thing I find is, there's a lot of cultural similarity. How many of you have been to Mexico? Anyone? Oh, wow, really? But anyone not Cancun, not Puerto Vallarta? Okay, so you have a few. You don't feel like you're in a foreign country, right? I mean, food is similar, the environment is similar. So we find that the developers in Mexico can understand the business problems a lot better than if you are in India or Eastern Europe. You know how people think. You know what a mortgage is. You know which side of the road to drive the car on. If it's a one-bedroom house, it always has more than one room. Now, in India, when one-room house actually has one room, every room is a different room, right? So there's a lot of cultural alignment. And interestingly, you find they are very familiar with us here. The number one destination when they go for vacation is actually US. Las Vegas, Disney, New York.
Right.
So it's a lot easy to communicate, not just at a technical level, but at a business level. So explaining a problem we find is really, really easy. But there's another thing I found out is, I still have a thick Indian accent. Trust me, I've been trying for 37 years. Folks in Mexico, they have a harder time understanding me than regular folks from US because they're used to watching the American movies. They're used to watching baseball and football. So the communication between them and my clients is a lot smoother than even between me and my clients. And that was something I had absolutely no idea. So it's worked out really well. It's become a little competitive space now. So essentially what we do is we kind of provide the fuel for digital innovation. So in order to innovate, you know, a lot of it is going on through digital stuff. You need fuel, you need programmers. And that's what we provide as teams. We call them multidisciplinary teams. And that's a business model. It's nothing complex except when you have to actually execute that.
Right. That's good. So you've had the fortune of having, I suppose, a career that allowed you to kind of see across borders, be involved in a lot of different countries, kind of see a global picture on how economies work together. Advice to people from an entrepreneur's perspective on how to gain a global mindset. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't even think of the fact that they could be hiring a team in Guadalajara who can write code for the app that they're trying to develop.
In the U.S.
Right, as opposed to being in the U.S. or learning themselves, right? So are there any tips, interesting things that kind of can help people expand and understand that you've...
So, you know...
Other than go travel, obviously, one, right?
Well, that's one, that's, of right. course. I mean, right. that's what happened with me is... the first 24 years of my career, I was only working in U.S., so I had no idea. And sometimes you get an opportunity, and when you do, you take it. If you that's what I did. When I got this opportunity to run this company in India, I had no idea what I'm getting into. I'd never worked with the folks over there. And I took a chance. So I think taking a chance, the same thing happened when I started this before iTexico. I actually went down to Mexico. I spent some time. And then there is this gut. You have this gut feeling of whether it's going to work out or not. Going out there, meeting people, got to be comfortable with what you're doing. But in the end, part of it is taking a chance, see if it works. And the good thing in entrepreneurship is if one thing doesn't work, you can always do something else.
Always move on to the next thing. How do you stay up on industry trends, interesting things that are happening? We talked a lot offline prior to this about if you put yourself back in the position of being in college, it doesn't always have to be about starting a new company. What are the things you're seeing, or what would you encourage folks in this room who maybe don't see themselves quite as an entrepreneur yet, but want to be in a field that really pushes the limits of creativity?
We've been talking a lot about that, and I spent some time with some of you yesterday. So how I keep on top, I'm kind of a news junkie. I read a lot. I have an iPad. I read Wall Street and New York Times and all technical stuff as much as I can. I go to conferences as much as I can, but I don't buy the whole ticket. Sometimes those are expensive. So I'll just buy the expo pass. That might be $50. Okay. But you can still get a feel of what's going on and where the industry is going. I'm in Austin, Texas. I network a lot, so I can see what's going on. And more importantly, I talk to my customers a lot. And they tell me what's on their mind, what are they seeing, and that helps us align where we may need to focus. In terms of entrepreneurship, Ken and I, we were discussing, entrepreneurship is not always about creating something brand new. You don't have to create something brand new to be an entrepreneur. You can actually solve an existing problem using new processes, new technologies, and create a business out of it. So the whole process of innovation, what you guys have been going through, I think that's more important than coming up with the idea itself. So I've been suggesting Ken, let's get some ideas from someone else who's actually facing a problem. And then you use your innovation process of design thinking, of business model canvas, rapid prototyping, use the process to solve the problem. Because what I saw yesterday was some of you were stuck with having the right idea. So the process of innovation was taking a back seat because you were stuck in the ideation stage. My suggestion is if you don't have a good idea, it doesn't mean you cannot be an entrepreneur. You can still follow the process. Let Ken give you a problem to solve.
Right. Take someone else's problem.
Exactly. That's what I do. I mean, I don't create anything. I just solve someone else's problem.
Right. But we forget sometimes that it's not like this miracle of creation, right? And there's some stats around this too, that something like only like 12% of companies are founded on new intellectual property or something like that. That means that the vast majority of companies are just, they're iterating on someone else's technology, or they're using someone else's technology to solve a problem for an unknown entity.
Absolutely. Some of them are... have become unicorns, billion-dollar companies. I don't know how many of you heard of Dollar Shave Club. what did they do? They didn't even make their own blades. Right. You know, they just shipped it, and they got sold for a couple of $1 billion. And then Harry's came along, and the blades are actually not very good. Has anyone used Harry's? Yeah, I use Gillette, and I know Gillette makes better blade. But these guys, they're shipping this cool, they have this cool website, and they have all these promotions, and they got sold for, I think, $3 billion or something.
Dollar Shave Club is $1 billion, right?
Yeah, and Gillette is still making those really nice blades, and no one talks about them. So they took an existing product and just sold it in a different way, and that's happening a lot. How many of you have the Swell bottles, you know, the water bottles, anyone?
You do. Swell. Yeah.
That is a over $200 million company. What do? They make the same flask, you know, this thermal bottles, but it's just a different packaging, different selling, it's coolness, it's social media. You can be an entrepreneur without having to come up with a brand new product. You can take an existing inefficiency in the market and solve it. Solving the processes Ken has been teaching you.
Now, going back to your industry experience, did you feel like that was really where you got a glimpse of how businesses bought from businesses? Or did you kind of have a knack for that? Because that's one thing we always think about, too, is like how hard it is to introduce a new brand or something into a consumer-facing thing. Whereas your company now, iTexaco, you solve problems for businesses who are in need, right? Yeah, what that process was like.
So, you know, one thing I think one of the reasons I also became an entrepreneur is because I couldn't hang on to a job. You know, I was a little disruptive, I was thinking outside the box. And a lot of times in corporate, you have to be a team player. You know, if you're thinking too much out of the box. So I saw a lot of areas where, for example, in IBM, where I worked for 8 years, when they design a product, they design it for the global market. So it has to work in all the countries in the world, it has to support all the languages, it has to comply with all the rules and regulations in all the places. So it takes a lot of investment. So you design a product, you launch it the worldwide, and if it flops, you've lost a lot of money, versus what if you designed it for one specific geography and see if it works, and if it works, then you scale it. But you know, their culture is, we are a global company, we are in every country,
we go big,
and that's how it had worked in the past. So there's a lot of culture in some of these older established companies, which they find it really hard to change. And that's where I was getting a little frustrated while I was there. And there are some opportunities to provide innovation even within the company. You can take an existing process and solve it. And that's why I'm a big proponent of this innovation, this design thinking, this design sprints, this fast prototyping, is make sure someone is actually going to use the product.
Starting with the customer first. Right.
Exactly. And you know, to understand where the problem is. You don't have to have your own product or unique idea to be an entrepreneur. Yeah.
Did you run any fun experiments? So you got to wander into class, but this is where we're at right now. We're thinking about how do we create experiments around an idea to test, you know, with a customer. Do you have any stories that were kind of like, oh, this is the first time we tried developing product one or product two, and how did you test in a geography or with a specific customer that may have been unique, interesting, fun?
So there's
anything
one
come to mind?
There's one client. We were working with, and they were building a mobile app for mixed alcoholic drinks. So how do, you know, it's a company called Monin. I don't know if any one of you has used
Monin. M-O-N-I-N?
Yeah, Monin syrup.
You know, syrup, yeah,
right?
They do like coffee too, right?
So we were building a mobile app to encourage people to use the syrup. So how to make mixed drinks with alcohol and all. So we built their app, and then they rolled it out in Middle East, Saudi Arabia. And suddenly they come to us and say, you can't show alcohol in Saudi Arabia. So now you have to modify the app. And if someone is signing on from Saudi Arabia, you can't show them alcoholic drink. You can only show them non-alcoholic drink. And that is like, so they had not even understood their customers before they came to us to build a mobile app. And then they went into China and they said, oh, but the language in China is different than English. Really? Yeah. it's double byte versus single byte. So now we have to figure out how to rewrite the whole app So it supports double bite.
Right.
And that was a huge waste on their side and our side because they didn't understand their customers well. They should have known that if they're going to launch in Saudi Arabia, you can't show alcohol.
Right.
Or if you have to launch it in China, it has to integrate with all their all the social media platforms like Tencent and I don't even know. And those guys are not easy to integrate with, but not understanding the customer cost them a lot of money. A lot of times they were angry at us, but you know, you want it in Saudi Arabia, you can't show alcohol.
Right.
You know, so you had to kind of redesign. And that was an interesting experience where you know some design thinking would have helped.
Right.
Or we could have asked more questions to them, and we didn't.
I think this is an important thing to note, too, because I always think about this, is that sometimes, and I put myself in this situation also when I was an undergrad or young and just trying to figure out, okay, I want to go get hired, is that we kind of hold brands and some of these large companies to put them on a really high pedestal in terms of what we think their abilities, knowledge, competencies are. But you can look across basically any news channel at any point in time and look at these mistakes and think to yourself, like, this is so avoidable had you just done X, Y, or Z. But I guess what I'm thinking is, like, the situation as an entrepreneur doesn't necessarily change as you move up the ladder. You just have more money at your disposal to do these things. And the mistakes may be really similar to what it's like on day one with an idea of your own.
One way to think is these are not mistakes. I mean, some of these companies are big because at some point in the life cycle, they actually did a lot of innovation.
Yeah.
They came up with something nice and big, which a lot of people bought, and now they're building companies. So for example, IBM again. I'm not sure if you know, if you go through the Fortune 500 list, for 25 years, IBM was the number one company in US. 25, no other company has even come close, not Apple, not Microsoft, not GE, not GM, 25 years. So they reached that stage because they were innovating. They had AS400s, they had mainframes. So they were doing all the right things for a long time until things started changing around them. Now you had PCs, you had microprocessors, and people's habits changed. And they forgot to continue to innovate. And they were always lagging behind because perhaps they were so bogged down with their prior success. So all these companies who are doing well, they are there for a reason. They did do something well at some point in the life cycle. It's just they forgot that they have to keep innovating, and that's when folks like you could come along and introduce the innovation for the same things these guys are doing, because sometimes you get bogged down with existing processes, with the existing culture or existing leadership. So you've been there in IBM for 40 years. Sometimes you're still thinking 40 years ago. You're not thinking like you guys are, you know, who have new experiences. So I think that's why it's kind of important for these companies to hire people with innovative thinking to help them, because sometimes they forget to think outside the box. And it's really important what you guys are studying, because you could be those change agents for even these large established companies. So there's absolutely no shame in going and working for them, so long as you can make a difference and not become part of their wheel. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it makes sense.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, I'm going to ask one more question of mine, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. And I'm probably going to steal someone's question. All right, advice to a 19-year-old in college today. What would you do to kind of prep yourself with an entrepreneurial mentality today that, not necessarily saying it's you back in school, but if you were a 19-year-old today, what would you want to do?
Part of it is, it kind of shows my age, is at least finish your degree. Make sure you complete the school. I wouldn't advise anyone to stop in between and jump in. You know, we don't hire anyone in iTexico who has not completed the degree. And for me, completing a degree shows discipline, shows commitment, shows that you're finishing what you started. So at least make sure you graduate and you finish. And the second thing is, you know, I still see a lot of curriculum which is kind of traditional, the books going on. I try to study things which are more current, you know, so you understand what artificial intelligence is, what innovative thinking is, and see what you could study which will allow you to make a difference. And don't get bogged down with some textbooks your professors is recommending. And it's okay to challenge the professors. If they're teaching you something which doesn't make sense, it's okay to say, you know, why are we starting this? Is it going to make some impact? Is it going to help us become better leaders, better workers, better thinkers? Can we actually make a difference in the society we are in versus learning something for the sake of learning? Now, what that is something you have to find. You know, some of you may be passionate about arts, so go and do things which will help you change in that world. Some of you may be technology guys. Some of you may have other passion. So I don't think there's one curriculum you have to follow. So long as you know that whatever you do will help you change or be a change agent.
Awesome. That's a good way to turn it over to the audience.
You have to ask me softball questions.
Yes, okay? Easy questions.
Easy questions. Yeah.
I may have taken all the easy ones, though. I don't know. All right, so who's up? I got the mic. All right.
Hi, I'm Joe Madrid. Ken definitely did steal my question, but I try to make it more specific. So you talked about like the issues of having a team that you weren't fully involved with. So like what advice would you give to somebody who's looking to take on an entrepreneurial venture but wants to find a team to work with? Like what would you look for in those people?
First thing is you have to be self-aware. A lot of us think we can do everything ourselves. So you need to know where your strengths are. Maybe you're a technical guy, maybe you're a business guy, maybe you're good in sales. So it's really important to understand where your strengths are and where you think you're weak, and then try to fill the weak spot. So if you're a business major, you have this phenomenal idea, but it needs some really technical stuff to make it happen, find someone who can complement you. Don't find someone just like you. And that is a big mistake I made. You know, I found people like me, not people who could complement me. So find the team which complements. You know, if possible, work with them for a while to see if the personalities match. I've not done any of those, so it's just advice. I wish I'd done all of it, what I'm telling you. I actually have a presentation which maybe Ken can share with you. It's called I Wish I Knew That. So a lot of things I'm telling you, I didn't do it myself. But yeah, find a complementary team. Find a way to work with them. You know, get to know them. Get to know their families. A lot of times the families tell a lot about someone's personality. The rest of it is, it's like marriage. You have to be flexible. One guy can't have all the answers. So you have to be flexible. Hopefully they're flexible. And the rest is a little bit of a game of chance. I see a lot of partnerships fail along the way. I'm a little fortunate. Guillermo and I, we are still partners. We are still friends. We are still family friends. But it's still a risk. So, you know, just be prepared that the partnership may not work out. And if you're prepared, you might be able to take that better. And hopefully you're lucky and you find the right team. And then it'll be all okay.
Yeah. All right. More questions?
Okay. Hi, I'm Maddie. My question was, like, you had a lot of different companies on your own, but then you, like, moved on to a new thing. How did you know when it was time to move on to, like, the next thing for you?
So that's really hard. You know, one should know when is the time to fold. So one is, I realized that moving on is not the same as giving up. So it's okay to move on. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Like in my first company, Media Prize, I didn't have a choice. I had to move on because I was upgraded. In the second company, Connection E, I wish I had given up a little earlier. I did that for 3 years. It was doing well. In the fourth year, I started realizing that the market is changing, I'm not in the right space, but I hung on to it. I had still that visions about maybe I can work it out. So knowing that time when you say, I think this is not working out, it's okay. There's no shame in failing. You know, there's no shame in giving up. There's shame in not trying. And sometimes it's gut. Sometimes it's your advisors who might say, you know, I think something is not working out right. Sometimes it's the financial numbers. And that is really important. There will be times where no matter what you do, you can go to a pond with no fish. No matter how hard you try to fish, there's just no fish in the pond. So that, you know, self-reflection, understanding of the market, advisors, I think we all know when it's time to move on. It's just we don't want to because we think it's failing, we think it's shame, we think maybe I'll just work a little hard. If it didn't work in the past for 4 years, chances are it's not going to work. So do something else, move on, and be ready to do that. I mean, just staying in the game where you're miserable and the business is working, that's not a right answer. You probably could use that same time to start something else. So I think in one venture, I stuck for too long, and that hurt me. I probably could have exited that business earlier on, maybe sold it at a higher price, and started something and saved maybe 2 years of my life. That's a really good question.
Also remember, if you ever get fired, just tell the next employer you were upgraded in your previous job, right? Yeah. I got upgraded out of my position. All right, I saw another hand up.
How do you like maintain your like past, present, and future like business and like personal relationships when you found your own companies or like move on from like previous jobs and maintain relationships like the previous employer and stuff like that?
I think it's really important that you separate the relationships from the venture. So maintain the relationship because I've hired old friends where we had to part ways early on. You know them, chances are if they couldn't help you in this venture, they might help you in the next venture. So maintaining those relationships, no matter what happens on the business side, is I think it's important. You know, you don't have to destroy a relationship just because the business is not working out. And people understand that. You know, you can fire an employee because it's not the right time or things have changed without losing that person as a friend. So I think, don't be an a-hole or anything. No, it's okay. And people realize when it's time for them to go. You'll find that if you're human, if you have empathy, no one is going to blame you as a person if you have to let go of an employee or you have to terminate a business relationship. So you know, be nice about stuff. People realize that it's a business thing, you know. A healthy business is good for employees, and if you have to make some adjustments so the business can stay on, they know it's the right decision. They'll actually thank you. I've had to let go a lot of people. Sometimes I had to hire them back, but I always tell them why. I tell them, look, this is the reason. Either I can't afford you, or the business has changed, or you're not in the right role. And invariably, I see a note called, thank you so much. We enjoyed working with you. Let me know if I can be of any help down the road. But you know, you have to just treat them with respect, treat your partners, treat your vendors. Everyone realizes that business relationships are not forever. It's no longer the IBM days where you can fire anyone. So that's just what I've seen.
It's an important note, too, if you ever find yourself in a position of being letting go, too, is to not be
able. Yeah, don't be upset. Yeah.
Right? Find a way to keep that relationship going. You never know when that person could be of help to you in the future.
And, you know, if someone is letting you go, ask them for references. With chances are they may know someone who might hire you. You know, they are in the industry. Yeah. Don't destroy any relationships if at all possible.
Yeah. Any other questions? Ooh, I saw.
So as a successful entrepreneur, what do you like to do in your free time other than drinking beers in Mexico?
Tequila.
Drinking tequila.
Tequila. I'm a big tennis player. I used to play for college. I still do. I have a little bit situation with the meniscus, but I play tennis. I really enjoy watching movies. I used to read a lot till I had to put reading glasses on, and now it's become a little inconvenient to read. So I've stopped reading on books, but I read that on iPad. I travel. I like to travel. So every year we want to go and visit a different country. This year there have been a few personal situations in our family where I haven't traveled quite as much. But more importantly, I try to enjoy the work. Because if you get miserable in work, it's going to consume you. And you can't enjoy anything else. So I try to enjoy work. I try to feel good about it. I try to be happy even sometimes when things are not going well. Because chances are you're spending 9-10 hours of your day working. You might as well have fun. And if it is not being fun, then we find something else. So that sometimes becomes a vacation for me. Going to work is actually having fun. Meeting people, solving problems, meeting customers, making a sale, making some profit, bringing some money home. I think that should become a source of joy, the business or the work you're in, and not try to seek joy outside of work. I mean, if you can have both, it's even better. But if you're miserable at work and you're trying to find joy outside it, chances are it's not going to work because you're going to be thinking about work because you're not having joy there. So try to find something you really, really enjoy. And that would be really something which will help you keep going. And the others, it'll be easier to have fun, easier to have vacations, easier to have beer with friends or tequila, whatever. You'll find you're happier when you're happy at work.
Can that be seen as an indication to exit if like your work no longer?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you probably would know when it's time to move on. It could be exit, find something else. Yeah, the day the work stops becoming joy, it's not fun.
That's good advice to any of you in the room who are seniors also, or those of you who are going to be exploring the internship market, is pay attention to your mood when you're on these, if you have the opportunity to do an internship. Like, is this the type of setting you want to be in? I've been in a few of these roles where you go to work and you're completely miserable. Then every night you basically talk yourself up about how, oh, tomorrow's going to be so much better. Comes and all those dreams are immediately dashed away like super fast. So
if it was not fun today,
10 hours of
it's not going to be fun tomorrow.
Right. You're going to be able to change that culture overnight.
So if you don't enjoy programming, and this pays a lot of money, you might be able to do it for 5 months, 6 months, but eventually you'll decide, I don't want to do it.
Hello. I was just curious. I'm sure in the process of building your business, you face some struggles, some failures on a business level or personal level. I was just curious what kind of things you faced and how you overcame those.
So, one thing is you got to have faith in you. Usually, if things are not going well, either is temporary or is permanent. I know it doesn't make sense. If it is temporary, you can fix it. So have some faith. Find out what the root cause is. See if you can fix it. Sometimes it could be cash flow. Sometimes you're just not doing the right thing. It's all, don't give up if there is a short-term failure. See if it's fixable. And if it is not, then maybe you have to start thinking of something else. But perseverance, faith, understanding the root cause. Once we started running out of money, so that became my number one challenge to solve. And I found some friends who were able to give us some loans to help us with the cash flow. But I knew what the problem was, so I could focus on it and I was able to solve it. If I didn't go after the root cause, I may not be here by now because I won't be able to meet my payroll. So, if things are not going well, chances are it's one or two things which need fixing. Just focus on that. Maybe the rest can wait or it'll get fixed along the way. And I'm sorry if some of my answers are a little too generic, and I can maybe give you some specific examples.
Can you say a little bit about how you decide which ideas to go after? Because you said you gain ideas from a lot of places. Of course, there's multiple ideas.
I think we are all creatures of our experience. So I started my career as a software developer which was shipped to US to service other clients. So IT services, digital services, contract programmer is something I experienced. And as I look through my own life, a lot of my business were around my first set of experience. So chances are that whatever ideas you come up with is based on something which you have experienced, something you felt good about, something you thought there's an opportunity. Trying to conjure up with an idea, I think, I don't know if it works or not. I think we are successful if we know something about the problem, if we have experience, maybe you have seen some inefficiencies. But starting to do something where you have absolutely zero experience, you know, then you find someone who has some experience in that and then build a business. There have been businesses where someone just came up with something out of the blue. But if you actually peel the layers of the onion, even like, for example, Uber, he didn't come up with a taxi idea at first. He was doing a limo service. That didn't work. Then he thought of something else. And finally, he had some experience in the space. And then he came up with the Uber idea. So I think go with where you think you have some strength, you have some experience. If you don't have experience, maybe take a job for a while, learn the industry, and then solve some problems. But if you graduate fresh out of school and you think you can come up with some really fancy idea, I think chances are not very good. So team up or try or get some experience in the industry. But don't quit your, just don't go to leave school and think you can. I know there have been some examples. Maybe Facebook was an example, but it's really rare for someone to conjure up some idea and be successful at it. So experience, teaming up, you know, see where you feel you can add some value.
Okay, last question of the night, yes. Right here, wrapping it up.
So my question was, whenever you started a business, did you put your 100% like focus and concentration in that business, or also did you have a second occupation that you also put your mind to?
It's really, really good question. So you have to be all in. If you're trying to do two or three business, you can't be good at everything. If you're trying to do too many things, you can't do the one thing well. So if you believe in this, just go all in. The thing with going all in is you'll also know if you're going to fail, and you'll fail fast. That gives you time to do something else down the road. If you're hedging your bets, if you're having a full-time job, you're doing something on the side, you know, you're not going to do well in either one of them. So when I was doing my first startup after IBM, I was doing all these business planning. I still had my job, and I was going to conferences to raise money. And I was advised that you'll find your life being really easier when you go all in, because you can live and breathe your ideas all day long. So yeah, I think I'm all for all in. You know, go all in. If you fail, you fail fast.
Awesome. All right, with that, I think, I don't know, I can stick around for a few more questions afterwards too, if anyone has some burning ones, but let's thank him for joining us this evening.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening.
Join us next time on Monday. All right, see ya.
Hatchcast was created by me, Aaron Richard, and is produced by the Bridges Institute for Entrepreneurship in cooperation with the MSU Foundation. Gabe Hales is our editor and sound designer. Our co-producers and writers include Gabe Hales, Emily Anderson, and myself, Aaron Richard. Original music and sound is created by Katya Gaudina, with help from Aubrey Haas, Brandon Weaver, Caitlin Setter, Tyler Mihai, Gabriella Allam, Jeff Smith, Paul Jakes, Ken Smuziak, Desiree Melfi, Neil Kane, and Laurie Fisher. Thank you.